Chapter 1. The Good Season for Travel. July 20th, 1817. Manambunte, Eastern Madagascar. It had rained hard all night, as it had every night for the past week. Water seeped through the sides of the canvas tent, pitched under the raffia palms, soaking Sergeant James Hastie's military dress uniform. He had taken care to wrap his journal in a waterproof bag, a routine he had followed every night since he had begun his journey. Although he was carrying Spanish silver dollars and trade goods, his journal was his most important possession. What if he did not survive the mission? These were turbulent times on the island of Madagascar, as rival clans fought for land, cattle, and slaves. In an ambush, Hastie could fall victim to a spear or a musket shot. More likely, he thought, he would be laid low by the Malagasy fever, malaria, that ravaged the coastal lowlands. 6 months earlier, the last British soldier to lead a mission to Madagascar had been so sick that he lapsed into a coma that lasted 17 days. Whether he came out of his mission dead or alive, Hastie knew his journal would provide an important record of what he had observed and achieved. On this muggy morning in the tropical rainforest, Hastie wondered if he would achieve anything at all. Perhaps, for once in his life, he'd taken on more than he could handle. It was not a question of strength, knowledge, or character. The Irishman was large, broad-shouldered, muscular, the kind of man who usually came out ahead in a barroom brawl or hand-to-hand combat. He was from a modest background, but had received a good education. He had learned about agriculture, industry, and commerce. He could identify trees, plants, and wildlife, knew a little about medicine, and had an ear for languages. Hastie had distinguished himself in the service of the East India Company, working hard to prove his worth to his superiors. Yet he never expected someone of his lowly rank to be given such a challenging assignment. It was one that required patience, flexibility, creative thinking and cultural sensitivity, the ability to judge character and motive. Hastie had his orders, but it was up to him to decide how to execute them and achieve the objectives. He would have no way to communicate with his superiors on decisions and actions on the ground. It was a heavy responsibility for a 30-year-old non-commissioned officer. Hastie had not applied for this mission. Robert Townsend Farquhar, governor of the British colony of Mauritius, had selected Thomas Pye, the British agent at Tamatave, the main port on the east coast of Madagascar, to lead a mission to the court of Radama, the young, ambitious, and warlike ruler of the Overs. Over the previous quarter century, the Over kingdom in the central highlands had become the largest and most powerful in Madagascar. By 1794, its king, Andrianampoin Imarina, had defeated rival chiefs, uniting the Over clans. His armies then moved south and west, forcing other clans to submit to Over rule. His son Radama, who came to the throne in 1810, continued waging war and set his sights on the trading ports of the east coast. The British had taken the islands of Mauritius and Bourbon, today Réunion, from the French in 1810 during the Napoleonic Wars. Under the 1814 Treaty of Paris, France regained Bourbon and was reasserting its military and economic power in the southern Indian Ocean. For the British, an alliance with the dominant power in Madagascar would strengthen their position and protect the sea lanes to India. For more than a century, the plantation economies of Mauritius and Bourbon had depended on slave labour, imported from Madagascar, Mozambique, and East Africa. In 1807, the British Parliament banned the import of slaves to its colonies. Navy ships patrolling between Madagascar and Mauritius and Bourbon boarded and seized slave trading ships, but they could not prevent smugglers from landing their human cargo in isolated coves in the middle of the night. In Mauritius, Governor Farquhar realized that the only solution was to break the supply chain at its source, to negotiate a treaty with the Overking to ban the slave trade. Farquhar, under pressure from London, had already sent two missions to Radama's court. When Pye fell ill and was unable to travel, Hasty, his deputy, had to step up to become the governor's official envoy. What would it take to persuade Radama to stop the lucrative slave trade? Hasty learned from the leaders of the two previous missions that the king's ministers and army commanders profited from the sale of war captives and opposed a ban. Hasty had come bearing gifts, but he realised that the key to an alliance was to build a personal relationship with Radama, to become his trusted adviser. How would the king receive him, a mere sergeant who did not speak the Malagasy language or know the culture and had no experience in diplomacy? What had Farquhar seen in him that made him believe he could engage in delicate negotiations and induce the king to abandon the slave trade? Hasty put aside these weighty matters as he lifted the front flap of the tent, surveyed the campsite, and wondered how his party would make it through another day of exhausting travel. It was already 6:30, but the sun had not yet pierced through the thick fog. The porters lay stretched out on the mud under the palm trees. Hasty's interpreter told him they were Manmeet, free labourers who served as porters and couriers. He had to provide food, hire canoes to cross lagoons and rivers, and arm them if the party passed through a conflict zone. "They work only for money," wrote Hasty. "I had a lot of difficulty dealing with them over the price of my transport and that of my baggage." It had been 16 days since the Navy frigate HMS Phaeton arrived at Tamatave after the 5-day voyage from Port Louis, the capital of Mauritius. Hasty was accompanied by Radama's two younger brothers, Ratafika and Rahovi, whom he had tutored for the past 9 months. Radama, with an army of 30,000, had advanced close to the coast, seeking to secure a trade route for the export of slaves. The Betsi Misaraka, a loose confederation of clans that resisted over-authority, were fighting Radama's forces. Both armies destroyed villages, looted food stores, stole cattle, and took captives, forcing inhabitants to flee into the forest. The captain of the Phaeton sent two officers on a reconnaissance mission to meet with the local chief, Jean René, and negotiate with Radama. After a truce was concluded, Hasty and the princes disembarked. Travelling south by canoe and raft across the Pangalane, a string of lagoons near the coast, Hasty's party passed village after village where almost every house had been burned. Food was scarce. The lagoons full of submerged trees were perilous to cross. Between them, Hasty joined the Manmeet in hauling canoes across rough paths. Close to the coast, the wind whipped up the water into waves. 3 days earlier, a raft had capsized, and the prize horse, a gift for the king, had drowned. Now the slippery path wound up through the forest of the foothills, the first stage of the climb to the highlands. "The road is nothing but ascents and descents all the time," wrote Hasty. "Past 6 mountain streams, swelled by the rain. A thick fog prevents us from seeing far." A military man, Hasty was disciplined in keeping his daily journal. He had orders from Farquhar's chief secretary to record everything he observed in the smallest details. He noted the weather, distances, place names, the number of houses and huts in each village, landscape features, wildlife, vegetation, agriculture, and the occupations of the people. Hasty was not inclined to add personal feelings to his journals, but after stumbling up and down hills in the rain and fog, along the muddy path strewn with tree roots, he allowed himself one laconic reflection. "If this is the good season for travel in this country, I assert that it must be impossible to proceed in the bad."